thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figger. She's associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Christian Miller. Christian is the A.C. Reed Professor of Philosophy at Wake Forest University. He's a moral philosopher who specializes in character, with special interest in the empirical study of the virtues and vices. He currently directs the Beacon Project, which studies moral exemplars, and he has recently completed a five-year research project called the Character Project. His latest book, which we'll be talking about today, is titled The Character Gap: How Good Are We? It's published with Oxford University Press. Moral thinking and evaluation often occur at the level of the person. That is, we find ourselves asking not simply, what ought I do, but who should I be? Similarly, in assessing others, we tend to evaluate their behavior by means of concepts that ascribe to them character traits of various kinds. These are virtue and vice concepts, like generosity or untrustworthiness, honesty, and so on. Now, a long tradition going back at least as far as Aristotle takes the person's character to be a fundamental item of moral evaluation. But an equally long tradition wonders what exactly character is. More recently, experimental studies of human behavior have given some reason to wonder whether there is such a thing as a person's character at all. Now, in The Character Gap, Christian Miller reviews the philosophical and psychological material pertaining to character. He defends the thesis that although there is such a thing as character, most of us lack both the virtues and the vices. So there's a lot to talk about. But why don't we start, as we normally do, by greeting our guest. Hello, Christian.
Hello. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, thank you for joining us. Why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was born on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, grew up there for about 7 years. But my parents moved down to Florida, where I would really say that was my childhood. Had a great time living near the beach in Florida, going out and surfing and boogie boarding and skimboarding and snorkeling, and just kind of very, very special memories of that time when I was growing up. Then I was off to college at Princeton, where I majored in philosophy, followed by graduate school at Notre Dame, where I focused for my PhD in philosophy on the topic of the foundations of morality. Where does morality come from? Is it objective or relative? And then from there, I was extremely fortunate to be hired by Wake Forest University, coming right out of graduate school, where I've been for the last 14 years. So I got my PhD in 2004, started at Wake Forest, and I've just been really happy here. It's a wonderful school where I have an opportunity to work closely with undergraduate students, as well as dedicate time to my research. About 10 years ago, I got especially interested in the topic of character. That was a big change for me, and this is what we'll be talking about today, I know. But early on in my career, I was working mainly in the area of metaethics, the foundations of morality. And I got just really intrigued by empirical questions and philosophical questions about character, and kind of did a big pivot about 10 years ago. And the one result of all that is The Character Gap, the book we'll be discussing in a moment.
Well, fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the you've done a great job as a philosopher in getting your research funded and in working outside of the confines of philosophy and, you know, working in research endeavors with people outside of philosophy. Can you tell us just a little bit about the Beacon Project and the Character Project, the two major research projects you've been involved with recently?
Sure. So about 80 years ago, we were in discussions with the Templeton Foundation. That's the foundation that funds both of these projects, because they were really trying to identify universities where a lot of activity was happening around a given issue. So, for example, they funded a big project on free will at Florida State. And in our case, they knew that there was a lot of work going on in character, both in the philosophy department, but also in our psychology department, where we have some of the top personality psychologists in the world, who were probing the dynamics and the nature of character from a more empirical perspective. So they said, would you be interested in working on a project where you would be doing research at Wake Forest, but you would also be involved in funding new research around the world on the topic of character? And we said yes, and we had to go through a very arduous application process and with the external review and so forth. But the upshot of it was that we launched the character project, again, about 7 or 8 years ago, which had two main focuses. One was internal at Wake Forest, where we would do our own research. And then the second one, what I'm kind of most proud of, is the fact that we were able to support 28 scholars around the world in the areas of philosophy, psychology, and theology, who were doing new and innovative projects that might not have been funded otherwise or supported otherwise. And we were able to give them either 1 or 2 year research grants to carry out their research on everything from the emergence of character in 9-month-old infants to a virtual reality replication of the Milgram experiments to a new account of the virtue of humility. So there was a lot going on with that project. Subsequently, with the Beacon Project, we've done the same kind of thing, but with a much more narrow focus on what we call the morally exceptional, the best of the best, moral saints, moral heroes, moral exemplars, looking at them, again, from the perspectives of philosophy, psychology, and theology, with targeting younger scholars who have interesting and new ideas that we want to support.
Well, that's fabulous. Why don't we get to talk about the book?
lots we could talk about there too. But.
Yeah. So why don't we just pick up with what you had just a moment ago characterized as sort of a pivot or a turning point, and then even just as you were just saying that so much of your work is at least recently is focused on the idea of character and exploring the different philosophical and psychological questions with respect to character. So you've published earlier work on character as well. Maybe one place to start as a way into talking about the character gap, the book, is can you tell us a little bit about why one might think that character is a good starting place for moral philosophy? Why think that that would be some place to begin thinking about ethics?
Sure, and I wouldn't want to say something too strong here. I wouldn't want to say that all of ethics is based on character or is reducible to character, but I do think character is one central component of ethics. And we see this in our ordinary life. So in our appraisals of other people, we often use character appraisals. So we talk about someone as a good person or a bad person, whereby we mean that they have a good character or bad character. We often talk about their actions as the actions of an honest person, or that was an honest action. Or on the flip side, we say someone acted cowardly, or someone did something that was unjust. So I think it's a familiar concept and a familiar way of speaking in our ordinary discourse. And in a more philosophical perspective, it's a way of thinking about ethics that goes all the way back to the earliest days of ethics, both in the West and in the East. So there's a rich tradition of thinking about character in, say, Confucianism, for example. I'm more familiar with the tradition in the West going back to Plato and Aristotle. So, for example, in the case of Aristotle, Aristotle thought the life of eudaimonia, the flourishing life, what we might call happiness, but I think it's better translated as flourishing or well-being, is centrally constituted by having a good character. In order to flourish as a human being, necessary and central components is to be a virtuous person, a person of good character. Not the only thing, but a central thing. And this tradition is one that didn't die with Aristotle. It continued on after him into the Middle Ages. It's one that's ebbed and flowed in prominence, of course. A common narrative about the 20th century and ethical thinking has been that character was kind of marginalized for much of the 20th century. Whether this is historically accurate or not, it's just a common narrative you hear, where for much of the 20th century, people were focused on other concepts in ethics. People were focused on things like rights and duties and obligations and consequences and utility and the like and pleasure and so forth. But along came people like Alistair MacIntyre, Elizabeth Anscombe, Philip Afoot, Michael Sloat, and some other figures who were very influential in restoring the concept of character to discussions in moral philosophy, and with that, the concepts of virtue and vice, leading to the flourishing of a different way of thinking about ethics called virtue ethics, alongside the two main competing theories of deontological ethics, which has its main support in Kant and Kantians, as well as utilitarians, who find their main support in people like Bentham and Mill.
Good. So maybe another sort of preliminary. Can you tell us a little bit about what we mean by character? I think that it's that you're right that everyday assessments and appraisals do have, we sort of reach first for ascriptions of different kinds of character traits, like that was cruel, right. or you know, how generous, or that was very kind. So, you know, we assess people's behavior by way of this sort of attribution to them of certain kinds of traits. But I take it that by character we mean something more than just a one-off that that exhibits a certain kind of motivation, right? A character is something more lasting.
Right, that's right, right. So the way I think about it, and this is just my view, and there are other ways of thinking about it too. The way I think about it, I think of character as involving character traits. Character traits are dispositions that people, if they have them, they're causally relevant dispositions, which when triggered can give rise to relevant thoughts, feelings, and actions. So it's crucial that for character is not just a matter of behavior. It has psychological underpinnings in both thought and feeling or emotion. And it's traces back to causal dispositions. These causal dispositions are not just, as you said, one-off. They tend to be stable over time, and they tend to be cross-situational as well. So that's a whole bunch of jargon. That's a whole bunch of abstract language there. Let me give an example I think would make it a little bit more concrete.
Right.
So to take something like compassion. Compassion is today one of the kind of paradigm virtues, which is a subset of the character traits. A compassionate person is someone who has the disposition of compassion, the virtue of compassion, a disposition, which, when triggered, gives rise to compassionate thoughts, thoughts about the suffering of others, or a particular other person, perhaps. Compassionate feelings, so perhaps some motivation to alleviate someone's suffering, or, and this is altruistic motivation, selfless motivation in the case of compassion. And then jointly, those compassionate thoughts and motivations can give rise to compassionate behavior, actual helping behavior aimed towards, alleviating the suffering of another person. But it's not just one-off. It's not just in one moment or one time when someone's dropped papers or needs to be taken to the hospital. It's usually expected that a compassionate person will exhibit these patterns of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors in a variety of situations where helping is involved, or there's an opportunity to help. That could be situations of being in the classroom, the courtroom, at home, in the office, the bar, on the road, and stably over time. So it's not just a compassionate person's compassion today, but never again. A compassionate person is expected to exhibit compassion today, the next day, the next week, the next year, and so forth. So a number of features there, cross-situational consistency, stability over time with a thinking dimension, a feeling dimension, and a behavioral dimension.
Excellent. So so we've got the view that sort of, you know, character is this sort of complex of various dispositional traits. And now, one thing you haven't brought into the story, which is a common common ingredient of talking about character, at least among virtue ethicists, is first of all the distinction between good and bad character traits, right? These are the virtues and the vices.
Right.
And also, and this will be the question, sort of, so can you tell us a little bit about virtues and vices and why, at least in the book, the standard amongst especially Neo-Aristotelians to identify virtues as the mean between two vices, why that's not emphasized in your account?
Yeah, so first, the clarification is really valuable. So I think of character as the broad kind of genus term here, and it comes in various species. one species of the virtues. So this can be the intrinsically good, since we're focusing on moral character here in our discussion, the intrinsically morally good character traits. Then we have the vices. Obviously, they're the opposite. And we can come up with examples of each, I think pretty uncontroversial examples of each, say honesty and dishonesty or compassion and cruelty. On the second question, so this is just a little bit of background first. This is an idea, the doctrine of the mean, it goes back to Aristotle most famously, where for any virtue, there's going to be opposing vices, so kind of excess and a deficiency. So there's going to be too much and too little. And I should have talked about that. I probably should have. I mean, since it is so historically influential, but I didn't for a couple of reasons. One, it didn't seem like it would serve much purpose for what I was going to talk about in the rest of the book. And two, I think it's not correct if, whether this is Aristotle's view or not, at least let's just take this as a stereotypical view, where for any virtue, there are two and only two vices, and they have to furthermore be an excess and a deficiency. I think that's probably too limiting, too narrow a way to think about vices. I don't see why, in principle, a given virtue couldn't have a multitude of vices, more than two. So take honesty, for example. I think their honesty covers a large amount of moral territory, and there are a number of different ways of failing to be honest. So, for example, honesty pertains to cheating. Honesty pertains to lying. Honesty pertains to stealing. Honesty pertains to matters of promises, promise making, and promise keeping. Honesty pertains to matters of deception. So not outright lying, but giving a true but very misleading answer that is designed to set people on a wrong path. Those are five areas that fall under the purview of honesty. Seems to me you could fall short in one of them and not others, and you have a vice in that respect. But then we've got at least five vices on the table as opposed to just two. So I wouldn't want to be kind of limited by just thinking there has to be two vices.
Excellent. Excellent. That seems to me right, for what it's worth, by the way.
Yeah, great.
Why is it important? What does you mentioned the virtues as being sort of intrinsic goods, right? Or intrinsically good traits. The sort of traditional Aristotelian account, of course, says that, you know, they're intrinsically good traits, but they're also sort of constitutive elements of human flourishing or human success. What's good about a good character? What's good about the virtues?
Right. So I think there's more than one thing you could say here, and it may be that I can't say anything that's ultimately very convincing, but at least it provides some initial evidence that these are good things. And especially in the book, I want to introduce this question because I want people who may not have thought much about character to think, not only is this interesting, but it's important. This is something that I should care about in my own life, not just as an esoteric topic, but something I should pay more attention to perhaps than I already am. And that, of course, that goes for me too. So here are a couple of considerations, again, not demonstrative. One is on instrumental grounds. When we think about the benefits of character, there's some good empirical research which suggests that developing a better character is actually conducive to our self-interest. Now, I don't want to put it too much. There are some limitations to this kind of argumentation, but I think it's important to highlight because for some people, when you're talking to them about character, they're not ready to hear some more highfalutin philosophical arguments or to be talked to hear about how it's intrinsically good to be virtuous. They're what's going to perhaps appeal to them the most initially might just be how it helps them, why it's a benefit to them. So let's start there. Empirical research, especially in the field of positive psychology, which has found relationships between particular virtues and other things we tend to care about in life. So take, as one example, take gratitude. The more gratitude goes up, the more things like life satisfaction go up, more things like achievements go up, stress goes down, mood tends to go up, depression tends to go down, lifespan tends to increase. So since we care about these other things, and they look like they're linked to possession of virtues and degree to which you possess the virtues, that looks like an interesting way to think about the importance of virtue. Now, a couple things to be transparent about right from the start. These tend to be correlational studies, so the causation is still not very clear. And if we just ended the discussion there, I think we should be dissatisfied, as if becoming a virtuous person was all about just getting good things for yourself, just trying to benefit yourself. That makes it very egoistic, and in fact, may even be kind of work against trying to become a virtuous person. Maybe that becoming a virtuous person, it crucially involves stepping out of your own, self-centeredness and looking towards other things and other people. So one or two other points to make as well. You can say that, look, virtues are good to possess because they make society better off, or broadly speaking, the world better off. So would it be better to live in a society where there's more honesty and more justice, for example, and more compassion for those who are in need? I would want to live in that society, not just because it would benefit me, but just because it's a society would be better off. It'd be just a healthier, more vibrant, more flourishing society where overall well-being would be promoted. A third reason, and this is depends on the audience that might be speaking to, but there are all kinds of reasons internal to religious practices and religious belief systems for promoting good character, whether that's Western religions, Eastern religions. They often, in fact, in every case that I know of, take good character to be important for, again, reasons internal to their way of thinking. And then finally, I'll mention this. It's the most kind of speculative and I think perhaps unusual reason to mention, but often I find that people who are presented with exemplars, and this connects to the current Beacon product and what we're working on now, are presented with, when they're presented with exemplars of good character, that can be more moving than any kind of philosophical arguments. That you see, learn about the life of Abraham Lincoln and how honest he was, or you learn about the life of Harriet Tubman and how courageous she was. Or you learn about the life of someone you never even heard of, like in the book I talk about this person named Leonard Sosha, who for over a year hid 20 Jews in the sewer system of his small town in Poland. He was in charge of the sewer system after the Nazis invaded his town in World War II. He was able to hide 20 Jews in the sewer system. And each day for over a year, he had to crawl through the waste and the filth on his hands and knees through these different pipes to get to the safe area he created for those people. I mean, that just so moving, so striking. And when you look at someone like that, that can be a source of admiration. So I admire that person, but also can be a source of inspiration. So I feel like moved to become more like him. Not in every respect, and there are obvious respects in which I can't be him, but in the respects that matter, morally speaking, I can be given kind of reasons of the heart, perhaps more so the reasons of the head, to try and change my life and become more virtuous.
Excellent. So let's stipulate then, you've given us some good reasons to that, that it's important to develop good character, and that there are all kinds of reasons why the developing good character is something that should matter to us. Now, part two of the book, The Character Gap, runs through a series of empirical findings, or mainly empirical findings, some of which I'm sure our listeners will be familiar with, but not all of which, that have to do with the empirical studies have to do with sort of discovering or exploring, whether stable character traits of the kind that we are now associating with virtues and vices, whether they exist, and how can they be primed or called upon or prompted. And before we get to your defense of the thesis, which is that these stable character traits are hard to develop and few of us have developed them, can you tell us a little bit about some of the experimental material that you're interested in? Particularly, you talk about honesty and dishonesty and helping and bystanding and these kinds of things. And there's some really intriguing empirical results about all of these.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah. So in that part of the book, I pivot away from philosophy and more into psychology. So I'm interested in the question, which is the subtitle of the book, how good are we? And for that, I can't just sit in my armchair in my philosophy office. I wish I could, but I can't. and just kind of figure out what the answer is by thinking deeply. I need some data. I need some empirical information to wrestle with, to get some insight into how people are doing in general. And to preview the thesis a little bit, but not say much about it for the moment, what I end up with is thinking that we're pretty much a mixed bag, kind of a messy blend of good and bad. So in reviewing some of these studies, let me first highlight a few of the more positive studies. Positive meaning that they find results which I think are kind of encouraging and reflect well on us. And then I'll switch to some studies which don't reflect so well on us. So we'll do the good first, and then we'll save the bad for a little bit later.
Excellent.
So on the good side, let me hone in on the research done by a psychologist from the University of Kansas named Daniel Batson. He's probably my favorite psychologist, one of my favorite psychologists. I don't want to offend anyone out there, but and I really love the work he's done for the last 30 years on empathy and helping. So what he did was he noticed early on in his research that when you experimentally induce participants to feel empathy for the suffering of another person, whether it's someone they know or someone they don't know, could be a complete stranger, they're much more likely to help that person than our controls. So empathy has been well known for a long time. He wasn't the first one to discover this, is linked to increased helping behavior. What he did was he took it to another level because he was interested in the psychological explanation for that result. What's the motivational story which explains what's going on here? Is it an egoistic story, for example, that by doing this, you'll get praise from the person in need, or you get written up in the newspaper, or you'll alleviate feelings of guilt, or get rewards in the afterlife, or all kinds of different egoistic stories you might tell? Or is it more of an altruistic story where the motivation that's involved centrally is a real genuine care for the person in need, regardless of whether the helper benefits or not? If the helper benefits, that's great, but that's not the goal. The goal is to help the person in need, and the benefits might come along as a side effect or a byproduct. Well, I won't go into all the details about his research, but what he did in broad outline was devise a dozens of different studies which would test these different egoistic hypotheses and say, well, look, if this egoistic hypothesis is correct, here's how we would predict people behaving. Let's test it. Do they actually do that? And if this alternative egoistic hypothesis is correct, let's see what people if people actually behave that way or not. And so one after another, he tested these egoistic hypotheses and he found them wanting. Found them, they were not successful and they were not backed up by the empirical data. The only hypothesis that time and again predicted results, which were borne out in the studies, that the studies actually found, was the altruistic hypothesis. So that empathy increases helping behavior in virtue of leading to altruistic motivation to help those in need for their own sake. Now, let's assume it's good research and, you know, it needs to be replicated and others need to investigate it more. Let's assume it holds up. That, to me, is very positive. And that's commendable. If people are like that in general, big thumbs up, period. Now, I wish I could stop there, right? I wish that was the end of the story.
We all know the stuff that's about to come.
Yeah, we all know the stuff. So let me give you one quick example that's familiar, so I'll just be quick about it, and then one example that maybe is less familiar. The familiar one is the group effect. The group effect, the bystander effect in psychology going back to the 1960s, so people in the general phenomena is that people in groups in an emergency, when an emergency is going on and you're in a group, you're very unlikely to help yourself if no one else is doing anything to help. So then hence the emergency continues and people's suffering is not alleviated. This was experimentally demonstrated in a number of different ways, one of which involved participants coming into a lab one at a time, sitting down, taking a survey. A stranger would come in with them, take the same survey. The person in charge would leave the room, go into the next room, climb up a ladder. There would be this big noise of a crash, followed by kind of cries of pain and my ankle's broken and so forth. And if you were the participant and a person in the room with you filling out the survey did nothing, just continued to fill the survey, didn't respond, didn't help, you were very likely to not help yourself. In fact, only 7% of participants in this kind of design did anything to help, as compared to when it was the participant by him or herself, with no one else in the room, then with the same emergency, 70% helped. Although I still think that's not the best result of all. I mean, what is going on with that 30%? I mean, why didn't the 30% do anything? But still, it's much better, much better than 7%. Okay, so that's probably familiar to many listeners, and that's been replicated time and again, with variations like electric shock or a bully beating up a child or someone stealing cash or whatnot. A different line of research, which I also find intriguing, is much more recent. In the last 10 years, this has to do with cheating as opposed to helping and harming. And it is based on a kind of experimental design involving taking a test and being paid per correct answer. So often students, but not always students, are brought in, given a 20-problem test, told you're going to get 50% per correct answer. In the control version of this, they would take the test, do the best they can, however they do it, turn in their test afterwards to the experimenter or the person in charge. Then they would be graded. They'd be paid accordingly, kind of cut and dry. On average, in one published version of this research, they got 7 problems correct on average. The interesting version, of course, as you can imagine how this is going to go, is different participants, same test, same monetary incentive, but this time they were the ones who graded their own answer sheets, then shredded everything, all the materials were shredded, and they could verbally report how many they got correct. So there was no paper trail, and they, you know, of course that gives them a perfect opportunity to be honest. I mean, they could tell the truth about how many they got right. But on average, this group got, and we should say in quotation marks, 14 problems correct. So 7 versus 14. It could be that they were so much better. They're so much smarter at solving these problems. I don't think that's the best explanation. I mean, I think it's obviously not the best explanation. So there's a noticeable failure of honesty. I wouldn't want to generalize just from that one study to say that we're not honest at all or, you know, draw grandiose conclusions. But I combine that with other research on cheating and draw a bigger picture. If I have a little bit more opportunity, sure. The story doesn't end there, though, because there, you know, with that pretty cool, clever setup, there are all kinds of other things you can do. You can manipulate all kinds of other variables. So, for example, if you see someone who in this, we'll call it the shredder condition, if you see someone who kind of publicly acknowledges that they're cheating, then the group tends to cheat more. If there's this person publicly acknowledging that they're cheating and you know ahead of time that you share the same birthday with that person, the cheating goes up even more. So there's a kind of psychological identification with that person. But on the flip side, I know it's crazy. That one's crazy. But on the flip side, so here's to make it a little bit better, and it goes right into the mixed character, which we could talk about. Students who sign the honor code first, before they take the test, and then are given the shredder scenario, cheating disappears. The average drops back down. Or participants, it can be community participants, they don't have to be students, who are asked to recall as many of the Ten Commandments as they can. It doesn't matter whether they're religious or not, just that exercise of kind of doing a moral reminder, then cheating disappears too. So this goes back to mixed character again. So I wouldn't expect a really dishonest person to be influenced by things like the honor code or the Ten Commandments. I would expect them to kind of do that as a pro forma matter and then go right on cheating. But they didn't.
Yeah.
But
so can I just a quick question about the original setup with the with those who are in the shredder conditions?
Mm-hmm.
So their performance, you know, went from the seven out of 20 in the non-shredder condition to 14 correct answers out of 20. Why do you think that they admitted to getting any wrong? Why didn't they all just say, yeah, I got them all right? Why I got 100%?
Yeah, great question. Yep. And that puzzled the researchers too. So very early on, that this kind of finding would come up over and over again. In fact, in one study, they reported that cumulatively, looking at 800 participants spread over a number of different iterations of the study, only a handful, less than 10, ever reported getting 20 problems correct. So just an extremely small number. And so that these experimenters, and I'm not qualified to evaluate these psychological hypotheses, I'll just report to you what they think is the most likely hypothesis. They came up with this idea. Deep down, first of all, we do believe in some sense that cheating is wrong, but we also want to cheat if we think we can get away with it, and it's worthwhile. The rewards are, make it worthwhile. So if we stop there, then the puzzle remains, because in this shredder condition, you can get away with it, and it's worthwhile to cheat more. So you want to go for 20 and get, say, $10 in payment. But then they add a third element to this psychological story, which is we also thoroughly want to think of ourselves as honest people. It's not that we want to be honest people, it's that we want to be able to think of ourselves as honest people. And so it's hard to just cheat with abandon and say 20 problems correct and still think of yourself as an honest person. But it's easier to kind of fudge it a little bit, just, you know, bend the rules a little bit, or, you know, a moderate amount, and still be okay with that that way of thinking about yourself. But that's why they also say something like the Ten Commandments or the Honor Code are so effective, because once you do those exercises, then you've kind of made your moral norm salient. You've got a moral reminder that's fresh in your mind, and it's very hard to then turn around and cheat while trying to think of yourself as an honest person.
Right. And does this what's the connection between this kind of result and another that you talk about in the book that I think is also among the more well-known things among or results among philosophers about cheating when you're in the presence of a mirror? Or yes. Even just the crude picture, a drawing on a blackboard of an eye.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Yep. So the mirror one is one of my favorites. So that has to do with research in the 1970s, and I think it's worth noting that with the whole replication crisis going on in psychology, that, you know, something like this, it's an old study. We want to see replicated, and we want to see you know, how well it holds up also cross-culturally. But anyway, still a cool study no matter what. So this was a different test of cheating where a participant would come into a room and told, we want you to work on this task. And there's a timer, and the timer set to 5 minutes. And when the timer goes off, please stop. So once they were all settled and ready to go, the person in charge would leave the room, so that they came up with some excuse, like have to go see to the next participants. Leave the room, the timer's going, and the participant's working away. Well, the question was, would the participants stop after the 5 minutes? And overwhelmingly, in the control condition now, participants didn't stop. They kept going, and it wasn't just that they were finishing the one problem they were working on. They would often go on to another problem and another problem. So that, again, is not... doesn't prove anything, but it doesn't look so good either. The variation that you were alluding to is the experimental condition, where everything was kept constant. It was all the same setup, except that participants were seated in front of a mirror. Now, it happened to be a two-way mirror, and this is how the experimenter knew whether they were going over 5 minutes or not. But I think it's good reason to think that the participants didn't know it was a two-way mirror. And what happened here is the cheating was eliminated. Just being in the presence of the two-way mirror. Of the mirror.
Right.
You want to be careful about that. Seemed to have a big impact, such that why? What's going on? Well, first of all, the participant it was unavoidable that they would see that mirror. They would look up and see themselves in that mirror. That would naturally happen several times during the 5 minutes. And now, connecting back to our previous conversation, the thought is, well, you're looking at yourself in the mirror. So you're thinking about who you are, even if it's just implicit or subconscious. Again, it's you want to think of yourself as an honest person.
Right.
But it's hard to think of you as an honest person if you're in the process of cheating.
Right. That's fascinating stuff. So let's tie this together, because it's all brought to bear on what I would call the central thesis of the Character Gap book, which is some people marshal these studies as a way of drawing a kind of a skeptical view about the very nature, about the very existence, rather, of character, or the very existence of virtues and vices. You don't take that tack. You marshal these experimental results to suggest that very few of us are honest, but also very few of us are dishonest. That is, the very same person is often, or for most people, we are neither honest nor dishonest. We neither exhibit the virtue of honesty nor the vice of dishonesty, that we don't have stable character traits in either direction. Is that right?
That's right. So there, when we think about the empirical question of what our character is like, there are a variety of different options on the table that we could choose from. I won't go into all of them, but I'll highlight maybe the top four. One is to say most people, and here I want to say most, when we say most people, we're going to be thinking about people today, mainly in the West. Of course, we don't have experiments that go back thousands of years. We don't have very good cross-cultural experiments either. So let's keep that qualification in mind. Most people today, mainly in the West. So one option is to say most people are virtuous. I don't go that way. Another option is to say most people are vicious or have the vices. I don't go that way either. Why? Well, for the reasons we've already covered. I think when you look at the experimental data, it doesn't paint a picture of behavior and also underlying motivation that aligns with the picture of a virtuous person that I have in mind and that I outlined briefly in the first chapter of the book. But the same thing is true of the vices, too. When I think about the experimental research, I see some very positive features of people's behavior and of their motivation, which doesn't align with a picture of widespread vice. So those are two options that I set aside. A third option is to say there's no character at all. That character is an illusion or a fiction. We should stop talking this way. Maybe we should think about, you know, just forces in our environment pushing and pulling us in different ways, or maybe we're determined by genetics or other factors to behave in various ways. I don't go that way either. And I can say more about why after I kind of introduce my position. My position, interestingly, is actually Aristotle's position too, in this sense. Both Aristotle and I, kind of for very different reasons and very different data we're looking at, thought that most people are in a middle space between virtue and vice. The way I put it is we have mixed character. We really do have character traits. Character is real. It's not an illusion. But it's not good enough to count as virtuous. And it's not bad enough to count as vice. So it's a mixed bag, to use another metaphor. And the way why I think this is still character is that the psychological research does support the existence of stable dispositions to think, feel, and act in various ways. So there are these psychological causes in our minds that influence our moral behavior and moral thoughts and feelings, but they just, when we morally appraise them, morally evaluate them, morally assess them, they don't meet the criteria for virtue or particular virtues like honesty, nor do they meet the criteria for vice or particular vices like dishonesty. So the way to perhaps illustrate that, one way to illustrate that, goes back to what we were just talking about with cheating. So when I look at that research on the shredder condition and the cheating behavior, and not just that research, lots of other research too, but just since we've already highlighted that, I think to myself, does this pattern of behavior look to me like the pattern of behavior of a virtuous person, an honest person? No. Dishonest person? No. But there's still a consistent pattern of behavior. We can reliably predict how people are going to do in test-taking situations where there's a monetary incentive and they have an opportunity to cheat and get away with it, no questions asked. And now we can also, I mean, so rather reliably, if the studies hold up and the replications work and all that, predict how they behave when there are moral reminders presented to them first, when they're given the honor code or when they're given the Ten Commandments or some other moral reminder. So we can actually come up with not perfect predictions, but there are no perfect predictions here when it comes to psychology. You're not going to get that. But you know, fairly useful, helpful guides to predicting and explaining people's behavior in morally relevant situations. It's just that the causes are not going to be the traditional virtues or the traditional vices.
That's interesting. I know this is this next question is a little bit outside of the purview of the book, but I did want to ask, even if the answer has to be sort of quick and dirty, what do you think the implications are of this thesis that, you know, we've got mixed character? What are the implications are of that thesis for The kind of conception of moral responsibility that is that typically accompanies virtue theoretic views.
Right. So, I like you said, I've not really investigated it in tremendous detail, and I'm not, I should say, I'm not an expert or not an expert in anything, but you know, I'm not extremely well versed in the contemporary literature in free will and moral psychology. With that said, a quick answer, and then I'll give you a longer answer. A quick answer would be to say, well, whatever Aristotle thought it was. Since after all, in Aristotle's view, he also didn't think most people had the virtues. He also didn't think most people had the vices. So he was operating with a picture whereby most people had neither of these traits too. And yet he thought people were responsible. Now that's way too quick of an answer, but I'm just saying I'm not the only one to go down this path. The longer answer I would give would be I don't see if there's a story to tell about moral responsibility with respect to virtuous actions, a story to tell about moral responsibility with respect to vicious actions, why that story couldn't also be told with respect to actions which stem from a mixed character. This is not a difference in kind. It's just a difference, arguably, of degree. We have a continuum here with virtue on one side, vice on the other side, and a spectrum in the middle. So to make that a little bit more concrete, suppose you have a kind of reasons responsiveness view of moral responsibility, where you think it's really crucial that people be able to, and we have spell what ability here and capacity means and so forth. And this gets me into waters that I'm not, you know, very versed on, but, you know, you have reasons responsiveness view about responsibility where it centrally involves being able to respond to morally relevant considerations. Well, of course, a virtuous person can do that, a responsible. A vicious person can do that too. Not the same, they're not responding to the same considerations, but they're able to respond to morally relevant considerations. But a person with his mixed character, of course, can do that too. So a person with mixed character is someone who is paying attention, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, to morally relevant considerations in their environment. Sometimes they're responding to good considerations, like the suffering of others, say in the case of empathy, like we talked about earlier. Sometimes they're responding to not morally admirable considerations, say the opportunity to make some more money by cheating on the test. So their priorities and what they're evaluating might not be aligning with that of the virtuous person, but there's still lots of reasons responsiveness going on here. And that to me opens the door to their being morally accessible and praiseworthy or blameworthy.
Excellent. Excellent. We need to try to improve our characters by and maybe improve here means sort of establish some stability in the direction of virtue within our characters. And so the book ends with a couple of chapters discussing various strategies for developing or building or fortifying our characters, and you end with some advice, and you talk a little bit about strategies that you think are not likely to succeed, or at least not likely to succeed all on their own. Can you tell us a little bit about those discussions?
Sure. So I wanted to make sure that I didn't end the book with part two. So I didn't want to end with, here's mixed character and, you know, sorry, see you later. Nothing we can do about it. Kind of figured it out. And I should say also that I haven't figured it out myself. So I'm just kind of, these are preliminary thoughts. Some things that seem promising to me, but it all needs to be explored in more detail, both philosophically and empirically, and especially the empirical part. We need longitudinal studies. We need to follow people over time to see what, with a control group and experimental group, to see what seems to work and what doesn't. So I end the book then with an additional section, as you said, starting with some strategies that don't seem to be too promising, and then going to some that show more promise. So let me say a word about each. On the not promising side, you might think one strategy is to do nothing.
Right.
And there's more to be said about that than you might think. I mean, life presents us with certain challenges, and we have to respond to them whether we like it or not. And often those challenges will push us in different directions. So whether that's, challenges associated with getting a job and keeping a job, or, relationships, or starting a family, or, health challenges and so forth, those just come at us usually in the course of events. So there's something to be said, just over the course of a lifespan, our character is going to change whether we like it or not. And it, you know, for concretely, conscientiousness, for example, the trait of conscientiousness has been found to increase gradually over time. I know, perhaps just through the normal course of events. But I want to say that's true, but we could do better than that. So let's see if we can be more intentional in taking it a step beyond doing nothing. Another strategy I consider it has to do, but think is a mixed bag, maybe is the right way to put it, is to label people with virtues, even though you have good reason to think they don't actually have the virtues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might have good reason to think that this group of people does not possess the virtue of honesty. Nevertheless, you label them or some individual person, an honest person, in the hopes that with that label attached to them, them knowing that label is attached to them, they will be more psychologically motivated to try and live up to the label, to actually demonstrate more honest behavior in the course of their lives. This is something that's been explored psychologically going in the research literature going back to the 1970s or maybe even earlier, and it's found to actually, in the short run at least, promote better behavior with children and adults. There are some questions though, that might be asked about it. So, for example, is this overly manipulative, overly deceptive? Is this, acceptable kind of thing to do, to essentially lie or deceive or at least manipulate people in this kind of way? Another question you might ask is, what's the implication for actual virtue development as opposed to just short-term better behavior? So does it actually foster over a long run the cultivation of the kind of dispositions we've been talking about to think, feel, and act in a better way? Or is it instead encouraging more motivations to maintain a good impression with others, or make sure that other people still think of you as honest, regardless of how you actually are in your private life? So those are two I'll mention there as less promising. On the more promising side, I go over a couple, three or four. Maybe just in the interest of time, I won't spend all of our time on that, but let me highlight two of them. And these actually connect well with our earlier discussion too, so I think these are the best ones to highlight. One is role models. We've talked about role models several times. The idea is look to role models of a particular virtue or virtuous life in general as the basis for closing the character gap, which is the title of the book, and the character gap is the gap between how we actually are and how we should be and the character we should have. Try and see, these people have done a better job, perhaps, than I have, of closing that character gap. Can I look to them as a basis for learning how they did it, as a source of inspiration in my own life, in trying to become more like them? Not, again, not in every respect. Some respects are going to be impossible. I can't become president of the United States, so I can't, or I don't want to, at least. So I'm not going to work to admire and emulate Abraham Lincoln in that respect. But when it comes to Abraham Lincoln's honesty, I could perhaps learn more about his life, see how he behaved in very specific situations where he was willing to lose a court case, for example, once he determined the truth of what was going on with the client. Mm-hmm. Or walk 2 miles to return some change that a customer at a shop had forgot to get. So that could be, I think, and there's some evidence to support this, a basis for trying to move the needle on virtue, not just intellectually, but also emotionally and at an inspirational level. Finally, the last strategy I'll mention here, I call getting the word out. Mm-hmm. And this is more a kind of educational strategy, where the idea is that greater familiarity with some of the obstacles to being virtuous can help us overcome those obstacles. So that some of what's going on with the character gap is that there may be obstacles in our own psychologies, in our own minds, which we don't even know about, which are, or at least the extent to which of them functioning, we don't know about. And that if we just learn more about them, we could counteract them and work against them. So the way this connects to our earlier discussion has to do with the bystander effect. The idea that in group settings, if other people aren't doing anything, we're much less likely to do anything ourselves, even if there's an emergency going on, even if someone is in desperate need of help. Well, what if that effect became better known. And of course, it is becoming better known in society. Now there's all kinds of training programs aimed at combating it and so forth. Could that be an effective way to lessen its impact? And I think there's some preliminary evidence to say yes. So in a study in the 1970s, they, knowing the research that had happened in the 60s, these psychologists had a control group with a stage in emergency. And again, almost no one helps in a group context where there wasn't helping going on. But the clever thing about their study was take another group of participants, and these were student participants, have them attend a lecture on the bystander effect, learn about some of the psychological research, and then see if that would make a difference in the same emergency. Not just the same emergency that day, of course, when it's fresh in our minds and it makes a difference, but you know, but not so surprising. I mean, they just went to a lecture after all. But they did it 2 weeks later. So 2 weeks after hearing the lecture, did that have any noticeable difference in the same helping task? And the answer is yes, about 20% versus 42.5% difference or helping occurred in the two conditions, 20% in the control, 42.5% in the experimental condition. So it did make a noticeable difference. Didn't solve all of our problems, of course, but if I could get that kind of effect out of a lecture, I'd be really happy. I doubt any of my lectures ever have that kind of effect on students. So that's the fourth strategy I'll mention.
Well, fantastic. You know, Christian, you've been very generous with your time. So I usually end these interviews by asking authors what their next project is. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're headed next?
Sure, I'd love to. So after working on this topic of character for a while and reading this empirical literature, I came to the realization that there's almost nothing done by philosophers and to some extent by psychologists too on the virtue of honesty. Honesty is a stunningly neglected virtue in academic research in this area. You might say in life in general, and that's part of what the character gap's all about. But so to quantify that, in philosophy, there has not been a single article in a major peer-reviewed journal in philosophy in the last 50 years on the virtue of honesty.
Wow.
There have been, you know, discussions of what the definition of lying is, or whether lying is better or worse than deceiving people and this kind of thing. But actually analyzing the virtue of honesty and the facets and its parameters and the motivational elements and the behavioral elements and what makes it good and so forth, nothing out there, at least in the way I just specified. So to make a long story short, my next project, which I'm kind of in the midst of now, is writing a book on the virtue of honesty that's both informed by philosophy as well as psychology.
Well, that sounds fascinating, and that it's one of the obviously unjustly neglected issues in philosophy. Who would have thought that that there are such things anymore with so many journals and so many people publishing in them these days? It's hard to imagine that some major and obviously important topic hasn't really been addressed. But I'm glad you found it, and I'm also glad that you're writing on it. And I'll look forward to seeing that book when it comes out.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Christian, for joining me today on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. And thank you, listeners, for joining our discussion. We were talking about Christian Miller's new book, which is titled The Character Gap, How Good Are We? It's published by Oxford University Press. Thanks for tuning in, and bye for now.